This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Almost exactly a month from now, the climate for grocery shopping in southeastern Wisconsin will see some significant changes. The first two Meijer stores in the state, in Grafton and in Kenosha, will open their doors. The stores follow the supercenter model, selling what you'd expect to find in a supermarket, but also things like you'd find in a store like Target or Walmart.
Two more stores will open in the Milwaukee area in August, and the foray by Michigan-based Meijer into the market is likely to have repercussions for some of the area's long-established chains. We'll talk about those repercussions in a few minutes, but first we reach Meijer's communications director, Frank Guglielmi. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for giving me the time to talk to you. I'm looking forward to it.
Why does Meijer have such optimism about its future in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, as we continue to grow throughout the Midwest, you know, we're going into a lot of different markets and have for many years. But of most of those markets that we've gone into, Wisconsin really feels the most like home for us. Hank Meijer himself has said this many times. The Midwestern values, we're a family-owned, privately held company. You know, family is an important thing in the state of Wisconsin. On just about every level, we feel like it's a great fit for us.
The first stores are set to open next month in Grafton and Kenosha. The Wauwatosa and Oak Creek stores are set for August, I think. What was it about those four particular locations that was appealing as your first foray into Wisconsin?
Well, frequently you'll see where our stores are located when they're around major media markets like a Milwaukee. If you look at Detroit or Grand Rapids or Cincinnati or Indianapolis. These are larger medium-sized cities that we have stores in. We generally kind of ring around the cities. We don't really have any stores in urban environments because our stores are pretty big. You know, they're about 190,000 square feet, and it's difficult to put a store like that in a densely populated urban area. So frequently, we kind of go to those communities surrounding those medium and large size cities so that we can, you know, basically provide our services and our offerings to as many people as possible throughout that metropolitan area.
They are all places that have quite a lot of retail already, even though Meijer needs a fairly large footprint for new stores. Does it look at locating within city limits? I mean, is there thought to moving into Milwaukee itself at some point, even if you're not obviously talking about a downtown area?
Well, we've actually found some opportunities in the Chicago area to build some smaller format stores. You know, in densely populated areas, it's something we continue to look at in terms of, you know, what type of store would we be able to put in an urban setting that would make sure that those customers receive the full offering of Meijer. And so it's definitely something we're always looking at. No plans at this moment. Right now, we're continuing to look at sites throughout the Milwaukee area, but also, you know, throughout the entire state.
Well, and that's, I think, an interesting point. I mean, regardless of whether a smaller footprint store ends up in a place like Milwaukee, I mean, there are some places, some companies, rather, that have rolled out smaller model stores. Why is large still such an important model? You know, these, I think you said 190,000 square foot stores. Why is that such an important model for Meijer?
Well, for Meijer, and a lot of people don't realize this, but the Meijer family, Fred Meijer, actually, who is the father of our current CEO and our co-chairman. He created the Supercenter concept in 1963. And basically what he did then was he looked at an opportunity and he got feedback from customers when they were buying their groceries. And they said, boy, it'd be great if we could, you know, get other items when we were picking up our groceries. And so he actually created that concept. That was actually 1962, the year that happened. And, you know, there's a certain retailer located in the South that a lot of people think created the Supercenter, when in reality it was Meijer. So for us, the model has always worked very well. It's part of our brand. It's part of our DNA. People look at us and they expect us to be a Supercenter offering. And there have been some cases when we've done some of those smaller formats where our customers say, wow, we love the fresh produce. We love all the grocery offerings, but where's all the general merchandise? So we do get feedback from our customers when, you know, they want that full offering.
The company made the announcement that you're moving into Wisconsin, I think it was 2 years ago. Have there been surprises in that time since?
You know, not really. I mean, there were some sites that were easier to get moving than others, but that's pretty typical in the world of real estate development. You know, we're in Wisconsin will be our sixth state, and as you look at our growth pattern over the years, you know, probably for every 10 new stores we build, one to two of those is a more, you know, potentially not as smooth in terms of getting it or not as quickly to develop as we'd like. But for the most part, you know, we've had great success in developing stores. So, I mean, we're pretty pleased, you know, we're off, you know, that we're opening four stores, you know, in 2015 in Wisconsin, and, you know, two more coming up in 2016. And then, you know, we've publicly stated that we're looking to open two to three stores per year in Wisconsin through 2019, a total investment of more than $750 million in terms of the development in the state of Wisconsin for us.
Do you know yet how many jobs these first four store openings create?
A normal Meijer store is about 250 to 300 jobs, and that's a combination of part-time and full-time jobs. And that doesn't take into consideration the construction jobs. We work very hard when we develop a store and we build a store to work with local contractors whenever possible. I mean, we do have a general contractor, but we, you know, pride ourselves on actually working with local contractors, subcontractors, when we're actually building stores. And so, you know, to say those first four stores are going to bring 1,200 jobs, it's probably lowballing it, because when you throw the construction jobs in there, there's many more that are affected by that.
You know, there's always a lot of talk in this state about the climate for business. Was there anything in the tax or regulatory climate in Wisconsin that made this any better a time than any other for Meijer to do this expansion here, or was this something that was in the works sort of regardless of the whims of government, if you will?
Well, for us, it really goes back to what I said earlier, in that Wisconsin feels like home to us. The Midwestern values, the area, Wisconsin feels like Michigan in many ways, which is where, you know, which is our primary home state. Basically about half of our stores are in the state of Michigan. And as we started going into Wisconsin, and this was different than Chicago. Chicago was a different environment for us. And then as we've moved north and got into Wisconsin, it does feel much more like the traditional type of communities that we have been very successful in. And as far as, you know, certain communities, offer different things, but for the most part, you know, it's been a normal kind of process for us.
You mentioned Chicago a couple of times. Has Chicago been a challenge? It is a city that is obviously the megalopolis of the Midwest.
Well, you know, Hank Meijer made a comment a while back in a speech he was giving in downtown Milwaukee, saying, you know, we're in Chicago because we had to be in Chicago to get to Milwaukee. So really, I mean, Chicago is a very, very, you know, high density area, a lot of population there. You know, we continue to grow and invest in Illinois as well. We just opened two stores this week, as a matter of fact, on Tuesday of this week, one in Rockford, Illinois, and one in McChesney Park. Now, granted, Rockford is not Chicago, but we do continue to expand in northwest Illinois as well. So, you know, it's an important market for us.
How do you guard against too much expansion?
Well, you know, we have the luxury of being, you know, a privately held, family-owned company. And for us, we've always focused on slow, steady growth. That's been really a mantra of the company. You know, we've publicly stated over and over, we're not on any mission to become a national company. I mean, we're basically, you know, growth for growth's sake. Not necessarily the right course. It's about what's right for us and our team members and the communities where we build our stores. So really, you know, if we look at a community like Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin and the state of Wisconsin, it's a natural fit for us to be there in terms of the offering we have and the types of customers we're going to be serving. So that really is what guides us.
There have been reports in some places that you're looking at ideas like online ordering and curbside pickup. Is that something that might be in the future here?
Absolutely. I mean, our technology advances, or our focus on technology and leveraging technology to help our customers, you know, continues, you know, every day. I mean, we just announced a program called Meijer Curbside, which is in one of our stores being tested right now in Grand Rapids, where folks can go online, order their groceries, drive up to the store, and they're loaded into their vehicle, and they can pay online for them, you know, or pay at the store. It's been a very successful test program. Customers are very excited about it. And what led us there was a few years ago, you know, we had a traditional e-commerce website where we were selling everything from, you know, paper towels to television sets. And, you know, we took a step back and said, look, you know, this is really, you know, what we need to focus on is what our greatest offering is, which is our stores. And so we basically took our website dark, our e-commerce site dark, for nearly a year and rebuilt it so that when you go to Meijer.com, it will reflect everything that's in your local store. So for our new customers in Wisconsin, when we open those stores, they can log on to Meijer.com, click on which store is their local store, and they can see, you know, 20,000 items, 25,000 items that are the most popular grocery items, and they can, you know, see exactly what's at their store. And so our curbside program is the next evolution of what they call click and collect, where you can actually, you know, look at the site, you know, choose the items you want, order them, and then go pick them up. And eventually we hope to be able to roll that out across our chain.
Frank Guglielmi, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Frank Guglielmi is communications director for Michigan-based Meijer. The company opens its first two supercenters in Wisconsin next month in Grafton and Kenosha, with stores in Wauwatosa and Oak Creek following in August.
What will Meijer's impact on other chains like Pick and Save, Woodman's, or even Target be? We'll talk with the Milwaukee Business Journal's Allison Botter when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we talked with a spokesman for Meijer, the retail chain that will open its first two supercenters in Wisconsin next month. The 190,000 square foot stores will feature the sorts of products you'll find at both a supermarket and also a retailer like Target.
And that could have a significant impact on the existing chains that sell groceries, clothes, home goods, and other items. Allison Botter writes about retail for the Milwaukee Business Journal. The cover story in today's issue is about Meijer's potential impact on the region. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
How much impact could four stores have on the grocery environment in southeastern Wisconsin?
Four stores, some impact, but what we're looking at is about a dozen stores over the next 3 to 4 years maximum.
So really, the four stores that are opening, the two in June and the two in August, are really only a taste for what's to come?
Yes, exactly. And they're opening up in areas that that they are growing, are developing, places like Oak Creek, Kenosha. But they're also opening in areas where you see similarly sized competition. You see Woodman's. You see, of course, Roundy's Pick and Save brand. So they're taking it kind of right to the heart of where that grocery market is already pretty divvied up.
Do they see these things as destination stores? I mean, one of the things about Roundy's and some of the other grocery chains is they're kind of all over the place. You, unless you happen to live really close to one of these stores that's opening now, these seem like places that they imagine people will travel to.
Right. Their value proposition is first and foremost with their fresh foods and their kind of grocery selection. And then from there, they're hoping that once they get you in the door for that, you'll be going to their home goods, to their kind of household clothing items, whatever those basics are, and really doing that full shopping experience in one place.
Now, one of the things you write about is this idea that even though there is not a Meijer store open in the region yet, the company's kind of already been here for 2 years. This has been a pretty savvy entrance into the Milwaukee markets.
Right. They've been doing their best to make sure you know the brand in subtle and not so subtle ways. One of the first ways that Milwaukee people probably noticed Meyer was they put a big, big sign in the Milwaukee Brewers outfield. So that was the most noticeable. But actually, their first move in the market was to donate. It was four food trucks to area food banks, stocked, of course, with Meyer's food. And that's kind of their general strategy, is going after, you know, they're not making the pitch for the mines. They're not saying, oh, we have the lowest prices and we're going to beat every competitor. That's the Walmart approach, right? They're going more for the hearts. They are sponsoring things like local baseball, Little League, soccer, whatever the community sport is. They want to have a presence there and get people, you know, where they are, where their kids are, and really try to make the impression that they are the community store, that they want to be part of the Milwaukee area in a big way and will continue.
Does that mean pricing-wise they're more in line with a Roundy's or a Walmart?
They do try to make that value proposition. When it comes to fresh food, they are competitive, they say, on prices as much as possible. But there's only so low they can go and maintain the kind of quality that they also want to be known for. So again, rather than making that big sales pitch, they're saying, well, we're here for you. We're, you know, part of our value is that we're part of the community.
So someone who is going out necessarily looking for bargains, who might be going to a Woodman's today, isn't necessarily going to turn to Meyer for that same reason.
Ideally, they do want to be around the same area in terms of price. But again, they also want to say, hey, you know, Woodman's, you go to buy your groceries, but here you can get your groceries, you can get a new outfit, you can buy a bedspread, we've got it all.
Now, when Meyer gets here next month, it will be on the heels of their entrance into the Chicago market. And we spoke with a spokesman for Meyer, and in not so many words, he seemed to say that Chicago presented a certain set of challenges. How is the Milwaukee entrance and impact likely to be different than what Meyer experienced in Chicago?
Right. So they've been in that Chicago market for many years. In fact, they said that the Chicago market is kind of a gateway to get up into Wisconsin. The analysts down there made it sound like, you know, they've gotten some stores established, certainly in that suburban ring, but their penetration isn't what was expected. And frankly, their share of the market is not as large as people were thinking. So it wasn't this, you know, world-shaking event for the Chicago grocery market. Here, the expectation is that there are fewer customers than the Chicago market, but all of a sudden there are going to be so many more grocery stores. So in that sense, it's a much bigger fight for the grocery dollar, and they may have a much bigger impact, particularly places like Pick and Save that have been seeing declining same-store sales.
Well, right. I mean, there are lots of grocery and home goods chains in the region, from Sendix to Target to Woodman's to Trader Joe's to others. So why is the Meyer storyline so seemingly closely linked to the future of Roundy's and its stores like Pick and Save and Metro Market?
Right. It has a big impact, if for no other reason than Pick and Save has roughly, between them and the other Roundy's stores, that's Metro Market and Cops, they have roughly 42% of the Milwaukee market share. Now, that's a big number for one group to have. They've got around 90 stores here in the Wisconsin market. And so the idea is that just by virtue of their size, they have a target on their back. They're the ones whose market shares these incoming competitors want to steal. Now, it's largely the volume of these Meyer stores that's going to have the biggest impact. Again, a dozen in about 4 years. So that's coming in very quickly. But remember, they're also not the only grocery chain trying to get a bigger piece of that, you know, largely Pick and Save market share. We see Sendix expanding. We see another Trader Joe's. We see another Whole Foods. We have some new market competitors. You'll see a Fresh Thyme Farmers Market in Brookfield in Milwaukee, as well as another Cermak grocery store. So it's a lot of people saying, wow, you know, Pick and Save holds a lot of this market share. Let's see if we can take a little bit of that.
Well, so then these other chains have stepped up their game. Is it more in response to what they see as possible to take away from Roundy's, or do they also have to do things to counter this entrance of Meyer into the market?
I would say it's a little bit of both. Of course, you know, spokespeople, owners for all these various groceries are saying they're not intimidated and that they're just going to keep doing what they're doing, even do it better. You know, but there is some reason to worry. Like I said, in Oak Creek, for example, the new Meyer store is, you can look across the street and you can see the Woodman's right there. So a lot of what these groceries are doing is they will be, you'll see some updates to the looks. That's Pick and Save. Woodman's out there in Oak Creek is also doing kind of a revamp. And they also will be, you know, as always, assessing how competitive their pricing is and finding new ways, ideally, to draw people in and hope they have a good experience in the store, which is what so much of shopping is about nowadays. Not just going to the store, getting a bargain, but enjoying your time there as well.
Well, and if Meijer is not, strictly speaking, about bargain prices, what is their entrance to the Milwaukee market likely to mean in terms of overall prices to consumers across the board?
Right. So they're not going for those rock bottom prices. It's more of that middle of the market to lower market. The way they put it is they want to be a store for everybody. And so what that means is they are, you know, if things work out as planned, taking little bits of market share from just about everybody. But again, in Wisconsin, that Pick and Save brand is probably also that everyman's store where they have those, you know, cheaper food items, but they also have the nicer stuff, right? And so it ends up taking from that middle of the market as well as maybe a bit from that bottom, a bit from that higher.
Well, and I talked again with a representative of Meijer about some other impacts, employment for starters, and he said each store brings with it probably 250 to 300 jobs. What is this competition likely to mean in terms of the kinds of salaries workers at supermarkets might expect?
Right. It could mean some upward pressure on those salaries because every one of these grocery chains, or for the most part, is saying that, oh, yeah, you know, we want this quality customer care. You want to come into the store and feel welcome and this and that. But, you know, there's only so many of those great employees to be found. And if you want to keep them as these new stores open up and new jobs open up, you've probably got to pay a little better.
You talked with a lot of people from a lot of companies and analysts as well. Did you find, is there something distinctive about Wisconsin shoppers that affects how Meijer is going about this or how other companies would be well served to respond? Is there something that they need to know about the way people work here?
Well, there is this idea that the Wisconsin consumer is very community-centered and that they do like that kind of local brand. Of course, that puts Meijer at a slight disadvantage when they are coming in from Grand Rapids, Michigan, a little bit of an unknown. Yeah, we've had Roundy's here for over 100 years. We've had Sendix here for nearly 100 years, and these kind of local community players that are already part of it. And that goes to explain that strategy where they come in and they're really trying to make the strong case that they are part of the community, they are part of the you know, group of donors that are going to help support your community and that you should you know, trust them and their quality for your family.
And so is loyalty a big part of the reason that people have continued to make Roundy such a dominant player in the market?
Right. And they certainly do their piece with the loyalty cards and things like that. And it's one of those where, you know, Meijer is trying to get those loyal customers. They've proven in the past they're very good about that. But in the grocery industry especially, people do not want to switch stores. Nationally, it's about 10% of people on average will switch a store. And most times that's because they moved. It's because they relocated or their store closed. It's very hard to change that customer behavior.
We've talked a lot about the grocery chains and their response. How concerned are chains like Target and Walmart about the entrance of Meijer into the market?
Now, Target is definitely, I'd say, the closest comparison, especially because they, too, are now upping their grocery game, which just adds to that competition. Walmart, again, sort of a similar offering, different pricing structure, different value proposition. But that's kind of the area where I think you'll see the most competition because, again, they're not just groceries there at Meijer. They have all those other options as well, and they want people to be this main shopper for that as well.
So you would imagine that the Meijer entrance is going to erode some of both Target and Walmart's base?
That would be their hope. And again, it will depend on, you know, getting people through the doors.
All right. Well, we will see. Allison Potter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Allison Botter covers retail and other beats for the Milwaukee Business Journal. You'll find a link to her cover story in today's issue about Meijer's potential impact on the area's other supermarkets at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then the still intriguing story of a decades-old Milwaukee murder at a still popular night spot. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. We'll be right back. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Von Trier has been a popular Milwaukee night spot for years. It's a bar on the east side which manages to be both vibrant and old world at the same time. But the story of how Von Trier came to exist is an interesting one.
So, too, is the ignominious end to the life of Von Trier's founder, Carl Lotharius, who was murdered in 1981, a crime that's still unsolved. Zach Brook writes about the life and death of Carl Lotharius in the May issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins us now to share that story. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What interested you so much in this murder that took place more than 33 years ago?
Okay, well, it may be an old murder, but it's new to me. I had not heard about it until a year ago. I had been looking to freelance, and I just heard the story. I was out with friends, and somebody's father had told it to them, and I was like, this is it. This is what I need to do. The fact that it was a narrow murder, the fact that it was never solved, it just seemed too good to pass.
And for a murder that took place 33 years ago, there are apparently a lot of people that remember it pretty well and a lot of people you could reach out to who could recall those times.
Yes, that surprised me too. And many of them, they're all in the same social circle, so they would refer me to each other and stuff like that. You know, a couple key players have passed on. But no, I was fortunate that there are many people still in the Milwaukee area that remember Carl. Of course, a lot of people remember Carl. He seems to be a fairly public figure at the time, but people that knew him well, it was surprising how many that turned up.
Now, this is Carl Lotharius, and people today might know Von Trier's, but for folks who weren't around in Milwaukee in the late 70s, give us a sense for how big a deal it was. This is a place that was owned by Carl, and he owned another bar as well called Oliver's.
Yes, that's correct. Oliver's was his first bar. He bought it in 72. It was a supper club, and so supper clubs were kind of going out of fashion. What was coming into fashion were discos. And so he turned Oliver's into a disco and he catered to Navy personnel and he started wet t-shirt contests. And it was kind of just a wild free-for-all place. And it made him a lot of money. But he also wanted a nice, intimate, upscale cocktail bar that reflected his German heritage. And so he bought Reeder's at the corner of North and Farwell when that was when the owner, Frank Reeder, decided to sell, and he turned that into Von Trier, which still stands today.
And it's named for the place in Germany where Lotharius was from.
That's correct. Lotharius was from Trier, Germany, and there's a roundabout way that it became named Von Trier. he named it after the city he was born in.
Kind of a roundabout way that he came to Milwaukee in the first place. Give us a sense for what took him here years before.
Sure. He was over there in Germany in the 50s working on a military base. I think it was the NATO base, and he was a bartender at the NCO club, the non-commissioned officers, and he ran into Bob Zableski, who was over there with his grandparents touring the place. Bob Zableski was stationed in England at the time in the Air Force, but he was on leave. So he met up with his grandparents, who were from Milwaukee, and they came over to tour everything. And they ran into Carl Lotharius at the bar there. They were there 2 weeks. Carl Lotharius got to know them really well, showed them around. And at the end, when it was time for the grandparents to go back, Carl asked if they would sponsor him so he could come to America, and they did. So he must have made quite an impression, and he must have had his sights set on it pretty early on.
Well, and this was a guy that the people you spoke with said really turned whatever he touched into gold.
That's very true. I mean, one thing that struck me about him is he was a very hard worker. It seemed that he lived to work, and, you know, he had a lot of success.
Well, but at the same time, I gather he also had some, or maybe plenty, of traits that might have given some people cause to do him harm.
Yes, very much so. People that I talk to are mostly Carl's friends, and they like Carl. That being said, a lot of people, I mean, even his friends were like, this man could be very hard. This man would not do anything he didn't want to do and would forcefully, like, tell you about it. And if he didn't like what you were doing, he would tell you the same thing. And he did have some kind of tyrannical traits. Yeah.
He also had some hidden or maybe not so hidden traits that maybe few people in those days would have been willing to talk about.
Sure. Yes. Carl Lotharius, a big part of who he was a homosexual. And, you know, back in those days, it was kind of hush-hush, even in the cities, even in the 70s when it was this big sexual revolution time. But that's just who he was, and it influenced his life. He never settled down with anybody, you know, and he was his own man. And, you know, for better or worse, I think sometimes he was probably lonely, but sometimes, I mean, it shaped, you know, who he was, this domineering, self-made guy.
You also said he wouldn't do things that he didn't want to. One of those things that he didn't want was let the mob be a part of his business.
Yes, yes, that's very true. I mean, it seems like, I don't know how much he knew about, you know, the mafia, but it seems like he knew some of the key players early on before he ever had his bar. And they wanted him to install vending machines in his bar, and he just would not go along with it. And that's one thing I heard, that Carl, he wouldn't do what he didn't want to do, and you couldn't make him. And the mob tried, and I mean, he took him on, and it seems like he came out the winner in that.
Yeah. It seems like it, but in the end, Carl Lotharius died a fairly grisly death. First of all, tell us what we know about the circumstances of his death.
Okay, well, let me just say there are a lot of rumors about how he died, and because the police reports are still sealed because it's an open murder investigation, it's very hard separating rumor from fact. But like, you can just ask around at the bar scene and you'll find a bunch of different ways. I was at a party last night. Someone was trying to tell me that he was stabbed with an arrow as opposed to being shot with an arrow. People say that he was shot outside of Von Trier. That's not true. He was actually shot three blocks away outside his house. There was an article where that insinuated that it was a heterosexual love affair, and that was far from the truth. What had happened, what we do know, is he had left Von Trier shortly after 3 in the morning. He walked home because he lived three blocks away.
And this is the winter of 1981.
This is the winter. This is like 4 days before Christmas. And so he was walking home. He gets to his house. He goes around to the back door, which is where he usually entered, and he was hit with an arrow. It was a 30-inch arrow, double-barbed razor tip, and it went through him. And the assailant fled, and there are conflicting reports from the people I talked to. I talked to two people that were actually there when this happened, but in the aftermath. But there are reports that he might have broken the arrow off himself, or it came off in the ground. Regardless, it came out, and he eventually bled to death in the upstairs apartment. He crawled up there to get help because he knew the people that lived up there.
You actually spoke to one of the people that lived up there, who was a business acquaintance of a business partner to some degree of Carl. And the one thing that, you know, even with the police report sealed, there is some indication of what his last words were, and that influence the police investigation, at least from the beginning.
Oh, sure. Yes, that is available in the medical examiner's report. There are news articles at the time that mention it. He had told Zebby, who was probably his closest friend, his name was Ronald Zableski. He was the twin brother of Bob Zableski, the man he met over in Germany. Bob Zableski lived upstairs, and he died in 2012, but his then wife, Lorene, is still alive, and she told me what she saw that night. What Carl had said, what he told people before he went into shock, what he said was, "Buzzy got me."
And Buzzy, in this case, is believed to be...
Yes, Buzzy is believed to be Herbert Dolowy Jr., who was a bartender at Oliver's. He went by the nickname Buzzy, according to all sorts of people at the time, according to his high school yearbook, according to articles at the time. He was Buzzy. So Zebby told the police, when Carl said, "Buzzy got me," that means Herbert Dolowy Jr.
So Herbert Dolowy Jr. was, I think by this point, he had been a former bartender at Oliver's, right?
Yes, he had been out of the picture for at least 6 months at that point.
And potentially, it sounds like he was someone that Carl was interested in sexually.
Oh, yeah, very much so. When I started investigating, everybody said that they were a couple. During the course of my reporting, I don't think that's true, but it's fair to say Lotharius did have a sexual interest in this guy.
Well, and so interestingly, Herbert Dolowy Jr. is still alive, and you actually spoke to him.
I did. I went down to his house in Illinois. He did not answer the door. But I left something in his mailbox, and he gave me a call a few days later. And so I had a chance to speak to him. He denied that he killed Lotharius. He denied that him and Lotharius were more than friends. He kind of phrased it as just employer and employee, and maybe just with a hint of friendship there. But they did go to Europe together. So, I mean, they were traveling companions. But he's been married twice. He denies or he insists that he's straight and that he had nothing to do with the murder.
But to this day, you spoke with people who say it really should be an open and shut case, that, you know, if they brought it in front of a jury would convict him.
Yes, many in law enforcement do believe that Dolowy was the guy.
At the same time, you also spoke with some people who think that there's another possibility out there, someone who might have been more likely to have used a bow and arrow.
Yeah, that's very true. During the course of my reporting, I found that there was potentially another suspect, a man by the name of Mark Taggetts, and he was 23 at the time. People have told me that him and Lotharius were sexually involved. Taggetts had kind of a stormy history. Taggetts killed himself 6 months after Lotharius died, and people at the time, his girlfriend said that he had been acting strange for the last 6 months. His sister told me that he was very good with a bow and arrow, that he liked to hunt. That was one of his favorite activities. So
Carl Lotharius grew up in Germany. He comes to the United States. He actually joins the U.S. Army, and you spoke with people who thought that was not his only official involvement with the U.S. government.
Yes, this didn't make it in the final article over space, but I heard from a lot of people that he was in the CIA. People were telling me that he had bags of uncut diamonds he would come back as payments. And this was because he was a German citizen and he went into intelligence when he was in the Army. That's fact. But he was a German citizen, so he could integrate in society really well over there. And, of course, this was the Cold War. It wasn't just Germany. It was East Germany and West Germany. And he might have done something for them. I asked the CIA. They would neither confirm nor deny his involvement.
Now, but an arrow murder seems like it would be perfectly in keeping with international espionage.
Oh, yeah, very much so. This man is a storm of intrigue, and that's why it would be almost ironic in a way if his death was caused by some sort of lover's quarrel.
This is a murder that happened 33 and a half years ago. It is still an open murder investigation, but is anyone looking into it anymore?
Well, you know, the police say that they're always looking until it's solved, but, you know, I don't know if it's a solvable case at this point. There's unlikely to be any new evidence unless they held on to some sort of DNA at the time and testing wasn't available. But from what I've learned, there really wasn't much at the scene. And that's why they had to rely so heavily on his dying declaration, Buzzy Got Me. But at the end of the day, that was not enough for the district attorney to say, let's go ahead and charge this guy.
Zach Brooks, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Writer Zach Brooks' article on the murder of Von Trier founder Carl Lotharius is in the May issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
One last break, and then film contributor Dave Lewerson joins us with a summer movie preview. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The movie industry has two especially busy times. There is the flurry of activity towards the end of the year when holiday movies and potential award winners come out.
And then there is the summer movie season as well. We've had chilly weather recently, but it's definitely not the winter, so this must be the summer movie season. Film contributor Dave Lewerson joins our Dan Harmon with a preview.
Memorial Day weekend was once considered the start of summer on the Hollywood calendar, but the blockbusters keep coming earlier each year. The 2015 season opened at the end of April with Avengers: Age of Ultron, which pretty much ate up all box office receipts on opening weekend and launched the season in which Hollywood hopes to make unprecedented profits, yet earn few, if any, Oscar nominations. And still, it must be said that some quality films that have nothing to do with superheroes or kids' stories are released between May and Labor Day.
And one of them, which still might be in theaters, which the both of us saw, was Ex Machina?
Ex Machina is one of the best, maybe the best science fiction film I've seen in many years. If Stanley Kubrick were 30 years old and alive today, maybe, you know, those kinds of comparisons come to mind. It's a look at a lot of different things, including, you know, the meaning of what it is to be human. I mean, you can't get into a heavier science fiction topic than that. Done very well, visually stunning, good acting. I just can't rave enough about it, and it won't receive as big of an audience, at least on initial release, as it deserves.
Just looking at the list of the summer overall, I guess I'm going to put it out there that I think that there are less action movies, like the traditional, what we think of as blockbuster. They are certainly there, but there's a lot of comedies, more than I think there usually are.
Yeah, there are a lot of comedies. It's been pointed out that there are a lot of comedies involving women in lead roles, more so than in the past decade, although I would point out that female-oriented comedies, you know, were always part of Hollywood going back into the Golden Age. You can think of all these great Katharine Hepburn, you know, type movies. But there are more movies of this ilk out this summer. I think the most interesting sounding one at this point is a film called Trainwreck, starring Amy Schumer. It's Judd Apatow is the director. She is a men's magazine writer avoiding commitment, a commitment phobe, who finds a guy she might settle down with. I mean, this what I like about this idea, it inverts the usual thing, which the guy who is the commitment phobe and there's a woman who, you know, he starts to fall in love with and he has to wrestle with bachelorhood versus the demands of an ongoing relationship. So it kind of turns it inside out. I think that has some promise for humor.
I hope, well, when you're describing it, it sounds to me like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, which was another kind of a soppy, you know, date film years ago.
I hope this isn't as soppy of a date film. Right. It'll be a date film, I bet, though, and one that maybe the women will lead the men into.
Well, let's talk about sequels. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few out this summer.
Lots of them. I mean, I wonder if you could divide them into the inevitable sequels versus the needless reboots, because a lot of people in Hollywood try to make a distinction between a sequel and a reboot. A sequel obviously has a number in the name somewhere, usually. Reboots have names that tie in with the preceding movies that are being capitalized on. Like, inevitable reboots. I mean, there's Pitch Perfect 2, of course, and Insidious Chapter 3. One that plays a little bit without the number is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. I guess that's a sequel. With Tom Cruise back again, heading the team and possible mission team, fighting a sinister organization that dares to oppose international monetary policy. But I think the geopolitics aside, people will go see it to see Tom Cruise hanging from the side of an Airbus cargo plane as it takes off.
Well, in the same, we just mentioned it, but would The Man from U.N.C.L.E. be considered then a reboot?
That's definitely a reboot because I don't believe there has been a Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie. I mean, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., of course, was a popular TV series in the 60s, and unless something happened along the way that I was unaware of, I don't think it's been in pop culture since that time. So it's an interesting, idea. But these kinds of things where you go back to 1960s TV shows and make a movie based on it, there's a long track record of failure. Mr. Ed, the movie, of course, being my favorite example of this. But there was Bewitched with Nicole Kidman, which I actually kind of liked, but nobody else did. I mean, there's a lot of these things have just not worked very well with audiences, even though Hollywood thinks they will.
All right. And other sequels, I mean, Jurassic World is out there.
Yeah, I put that into the potentially needless reboot. Let's be fair, because I haven't seen it. It could be good. I mean, sometimes these things work. I mean, Jurassic World is the fourth Jurassic Park movie. This time out, we have a swank resort theme park with reptiles roaming around. But, of course, there wouldn't be much of a movie here if the reptiles didn't run amok at some point. So that's one big one. Terminator Genisys is kind of interesting because Arnold Schwarzenegger is back as the Terminator in a story that leaps through time between 1984, the release, of course, of the original Terminator movie, then it goes to 2017 and then 2029. So back and forth across time, will the world end? We'll find out. And, of course, Mad Max Fury Road. I mean, that's been a dormant franchise for about 15 years, and the Australian director of it seemed just determined before he died to make one last one.
Seems like they're going to have a hard time replicating that, and I'm air quoting here, magic without Mel Gibson and Tina Turner.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of great inflation going on Rotten Tomatoes these days, and it seems that the majority of critics kind of like this movie. But many of them do concede that really the reason to see it is just to watch junker monstrosity cars chasing each other across the outback of Australia with ugly-looking people on board for the most part. So, yeah, I mean, say what you want about Mel Gibson. He was really good. And I think that the first, you know, Mad Max movie really did launch a whole cycle of often very interesting post-apocalyptic survivor movies. It wasn't the first movie that dealt with that, but I think it really kind of, you know, accelerated the move in popular culture toward those kinds of representations on film of a future we wouldn't want to live in.
Did the zombie genre take over after that?
Well, yeah, zombies became very prevalent. I think that we have a little bit of a break with zombies for a while now. That just got to be so overdone after a point.
All right.
But we also, I think, in this category of reboots, Fantastic Four. There was a 2005 hit movie. It was a 2007 sequel that the fans hated, apparently. So Hollywood goes back to the tablet again and sketches out a new version, yet another origin story for superheroes. We just can't get enough of that, apparently.
All right. Anything else? Well, Poltergeist was there.
Yeah, Poltergeist. yeah, I mean that. There's a new superhero franchise that they're trying to launch, Ant-Man. And a sarcastic person would say they're really getting to the bottom of the Marvel comic universe with Ant-Man. But we'll see what happens. I'm sure that there's a fan base for Ant-Man out there. And will they like the screen version of it? Will anybody else want to see Ant-Man? Well, sit tight and we'll see.
What's the Pixar offering this summer?
Inside Out, which actually sounds like a very interesting movie. I have to say I've been a little disappointed with Pixar the last couple of years. This one sounds like a great idea. It's an animated film, of course, and there are these emotions that live inside the head of an 11-year-old girl, fear and anger and so on, kind of vying for, you know, control or attention. The director of this movie was the director of Up and Monsters, Inc., which I thought were two of the among the finest Pixar films. So Inside Out, I think that looks extremely promising.
Okay. It wasn't always summer, but it seems like Woody Allen's movies come out in summer now.
He appears to have scheduled himself around a summer release every year. It's remarkable, his ability to, I don't want to say crank out, but to produce movies, you know, tightly budgeted, but adequately budgeted, shot, you know, increasingly in interesting locations. I mean, he's certainly gotten beyond, you know, Manhattan for the most part in recent years.
Has he for this one?
Well, I think he's getting a little closer to his old stomping grounds. This is at an Ivy League college. I don't remember if it's upstate New York or New England, but it's not in the big city of Manhattan, though. He's back in the U.S. with this one, though. Irrational Man, a philosophy professor played by Joaquin Phoenix, has an affair with a student, Emma Stone, and, you know, people could look at that. And, you know, has Woody Allen, as a filmmaker and writer, had a lot of relations between older men and younger women or girls? Yes, I think you could identify that as a persistent theme in his work. Here we have another example of it. His stock continues, you know, to be very high. He can attract some of the most important cast members of any given time and not, you know, pay them millions of dollars either. I mean, people, stars really want to be in a Woody Allen film because there is a prestige to doing that.
All right. And, you know, there's quite a few blockbustery type movies and comedies. Something that stood out to me as odd that it was being released in the summer is Mr. Holmes.
Mr. Holmes is one of a couple or several costume dramas. Mr. Holmes sounds more like a fall, early winter movie to me. But the thing about this is that the distribution end of the movie business does recognize that there is an audience for other kinds of things out there that for one reason or another, summertime might be a good time to release a few of these movies, which, again, sadly will get lost most likely come Oscar nomination time because the Academy won't remember them by then. But Mr. Holmes looks like a good one. Ian McKellen as an aged Sherlock Holmes losing his memory. Perhaps this is touching on the increased attention being given to dementia and things of this kind in our society. But I think it's one of the more interesting examples of the survival of that character. There's a popular British TV series a few years ago, still ongoing, that inspired a popular, though less interesting, American version of it. And the movies keep coming, and Sherlock Holmes just appears to be deathless.
Okay. Any other highlights for the summer?
Well, another costume picture, Far From the Madding Crowd, the Thomas Hardy novel. Much of it shot outdoors in the lush English countryside, lots of scenery and sunlight and frocks and things of this kind. So that'll be a pleasant diversion from, Road Warrior-type movies, I guess.
There do seem to be more of that available this summer.
Of costume dramas?
Yeah, just a non...
Well, another one is, this is, I guess, costume pictures shooting at a wider audience, maybe is a category for it. It would be a fantasy film, Pan. Origin story of Peter Pan with Hugh Jackman as Blackbeard the Pirate. This is directed by Joe Wright, who did Pride and Prejudice and Anna Karenina, so he's a past master of this kind of thing. So Pan, I mean, I don't know how adult that's going to be. It might be a movie for mature kids. It might be a movie for fantasy buffs. It might be kind of a costume picture. And Hugh Jackman, of course, has a certain draw. So that could be popular.
Okay. And we've only scratched the surface. There's a lot coming out this summer.
As always, there are many, many releases scheduled. And I would bet you, though, that many of them are not going to actually get out this summer and could be pushed back into fall.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor at the Shepherd Express Weekly newspaper. He's the author of its I Hate Hollywood blog, and he's our regular film contributor. He shared his summer movie preview with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon and the rest of us as well. And I'm Bonnie North. That's all for Friday's show.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Dan Harmon and Audrey Nowakowski and our production assistant, Claire Mosley. We get web support from Michelle Matternowski and studio engineering from John Stralecki.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next, followed by Here and Now at noon.